Welcome. Whoa, Resna 2007. Is this a little too hot? Is it too hot out there? Too hot here? Okay. I'm Ray Grott, and I'm your conference chair. On behalf of the meetings committee, I want to welcome you and your families to our family gathering. We prepared a jam-packed conference for you that will keep you thinking and talking, making connections, and having fun. But before I go any further, I'd like all the people who are at their first Resna conference to raise their hands. And if you can't raise your hand, right. And if you can't raise your hands, run over the toe of the person next to you so they'll shout out. If you are an international visitor, please raise your hand. Greetings. So to all of you, welcome to Resna. Welcome to our family, a family of dedicated, passionate, amazingly intelligent people who share a common goal and purpose, working with people with disabilities to design, manufacture, recommend, and implement technologies to help further their personal goals. Resna is our home, and we welcome you to it. Finally, oh, sorry, that's the trouble when you have notes. This home is built and maintained by volunteer efforts of dozens of people. So I want to first acknowledge the other members of the meetings committee without whom this conference would not have taken place. So please stand up or raise your hands. Glenn Ashlock, Barb Crane, Jamie Prioli, Susan Johnson Taylor, and Shirley Fitzgerald and Lisa Simone, who could not be here. Now, while you remain standing, Barb and others, please stand up. I'm going to ask the student design and student competition, student scientific paper competition chairs to stand up, committee chairs, special interest group chairs, professional specialty group chairs, and standard board chairs. Rise up in some way. Now stand, keep standing. Now, those serving on the Resna Board of Directors, please rise. Next, let's see all the current serving committee and board members, competition judges, and paper reviewers. I won't ask all the manufacturers' representatives to rise because they're already standing in the exhibit hall getting ready for us. Finally, let's add to this group all the former board members, committee chairs, SIG and PSG chairs who have contributed to Resna over the years. This is the volunteer. The heart and soul of our organization and the leading lights of our profession. And I'm deeply honored to be working amongst you. At this time, I also want to acknowledge our executive director, Tom Gorski, in the back, and the Resna office staff who have worked tirelessly to make this go as smoothly as possible. Also, our dedicated volunteer coordinator, Linda Szczepanski, who's probably in the volunteer room, and our conference planner, Cindy DeClark, and the fine staff of the Biltmore Resort. Now, before I introduce the keynote speaker, I want to remind those of you with us for the first time and others of you who have questions about the conference to visit the welcome booth inside the exhibit hall tonight. Please also come to our first-timers orientation at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning in the Grand Ballroom, and that's labeled on your map. After the speaker, we'll be presenting an award and also taking care of a little bit of housekeeping. I've been privileged to know Gary Karp for a number of years, and I invited him to speak with us tonight because I love to watch him juggle. I've seen him juggle living fully with a disability while helping and advising others new to that world, juggle his work as an ergonomist and consultant with his interest in wheelchairs and other assistive technology, juggle his writing, editing, and public speaking with his advocacy, especially for people with spinal cord injuries. As you read in the program, Gary has written and edited several books on living with a disability, including my favorite, Disability and the Art of Kissing, which I think says it all in some ways. He travels around the country speaking to groups of all types, promoting disability awareness, employment issues, and the opportunities and challenges facing people with disabilities in the modern era. All this while juggling a new marriage and raising a rambunctious yellow Labrador retriever puppy. All I can say is, I'm impressed, and I'm sure you will be too. I welcome Gary Karp.
Thank you, Ray. Wow. Thanks so much. A lot of you might not know this, but Ray and I, we're twin brothers. Get the similarity. I'm really so excited to be here. We are all part of something truly amazing. We are part of nothing less than a radical, revolutionary, global, and historic paradigm shift that centers squarely on the story of people with disabilities. Okay, it's true. Sometimes I'm prone to grandiose, over-idealistic statements. But I really believe that this is true. Huge amounts of human capacity, artificially restrained human capacity, is being unleashed in the lives of millions of people who happen to have some characteristics, though I like to think of them as features, that happen to be called disability. But disability as a concept is actually changing, because for more and more people, disabilities are less and less impairing. So what this is really about is potential. Everybody, every single human being has some objective potential that determines what is possible in our lives. And the question is, how do we get to it? So take me. I will never be a point guard in the NBA. It's just not a possibility for me, right? Obviously not going to be a brain surgeon. Sadly, never going to be a huge rock star. Never going to be... Right before the joke that now it's ruined. Never going to be a porn star. I'm trying to live down the disappointment of that one. But I've been a graphic designer, ergonomics consultant, writer, speaker, a musician, a juggler. These were all objective possibilities for me in my life. And I've just done my best to sort of find my way to figure them out. People with disabilities in general, their potential is exploding. And the people who are aware of their potential and the ones who make the decision to go after it, they don't think in terms of disabilities. They think in terms of possibilities. And they do not want to be denied at least a chance to take a shot at that possibility. And some of them are really pissed off. And in fact, that anger has been driving a lot of very smart and talented people to make what have been incredible changes, thanks to advocacy. They have been removing obstacles from this potential for people with disabilities. Now, you people, what you do through your design, engineering, implementation, problem solving, you not only remove obstacles, you are extending potential for people with disabilities. You are another major factor in this dramatic emergence of human capacity. We need to be investing in what you do, making sure that it gets to people. We should be dumping money on you like a New Year's Eve balloon drop. Yeah. All right, great, they went for the gratuitous pep talk thing. So I've been observing and experiencing this dramatic emergence of potential since the 4th of July, 1973, when I fell out of a tree at the age of 18. You know, you can laugh. It's either the tuxedo or the glasses or the hair. I don't know. Take your pick. But please enjoy yourself. There'd been a huge storm in Detroit and the surrounding suburbs where I grew up. And it really just tore the whole place up. And a neighbor hired my friends and I to clear his property. There were so many broken branches there, you could hardly see the grass. And we worked really hard for a couple days. We had a lot of fun. Broke up all those branches, threw them into a truck, took them off to some illegal dumping site. And then there was this one tree in the front yard that needed to be cut down. And a large branch that had to come off of the top first. And the neighbor wanted that cut so we wouldn't damage surrounding trees. So, hey, 18 years old, sure, we can do this, make some extra money. So what if I've never touched a running chainsaw in my life? I'll climb up 25 feet into a tree with one. And, of course, the neighbor was being extremely irresponsible, hiring kids instead of professionals to do this job. So, climb up the tree. Is that me? Or is that you? Please be patient. We're having technical difficulties.
You switching me out altogether?
If I can.
Yeah, sure. Test 1, 2, get some volume. Can you hear me in the back of the room? Yes, thank you very much. It's one of the things about being a wheelchair user, you can just roll with the flow. I apologize for that one. So I climbed up the tree. I was standing in a very, very stable position, leaning forward against it. We had tied a rope around the branch, but somehow it never occurred to anybody, let's put a rope around Gary. And as soon as I reached up to cut into that branch, it started breaking off of its own weight. The tree literally catapulted me out, and in a moment I was on the ground with a break at T12 and L1. That afternoon I had 5 hours of surgery, a laminectomy, and a spinal fusion, and I woke up in a very interesting piece of technology called a circle bed. Anybody in the room remember circle beds? We got a few, yeah. Yeah. Well, the rest of you, you'll just have to visit the Museum of Ancient Medical Devices. But you can kind of see it here in the corner. It was kind of like a 7-foot diameter Ferris wheel out of chrome tubing. The bed was the diameter. And since I had to lay straight while the surgery healed, the circle bed was to alternate me from prone to supine. And we did this operation every 4 hours, day and night, for 6 weeks. I wake up in this thing. They tell me that's what I had to look forward to, and it didn't strike me as a good time. But something amazing happened. I got in the rhythm of this. When the 4 hours was up, I was really ready for a change of position. Wake up in the middle of the night, we did the deal, went back to sleep, and this was the first indication for me about something that became a characteristic of the whole disability experience, that I couldn't know in advance what an experience was going to be. I had to wait until I got there to really know. I could have my fears, I could have my doubts, I could have those reactions, but there was just always leave a little space to find out what it's really going to be. And that was really a theme, this whole thing. So after my 6-week ride in the circle bed, they transferred me to rehab to be driven like a slave for 7 weeks. The weightlifting was so intense. They took this skinny 18-year-old kid and turned him into this hunk of manhood. What's funny about that? I don't know. I understand. It's true, isn't it? It's hard work. All about working toward my independence. We really had a good time doing this. Whether I was going to recover or not, I knew that I wanted to get out there and be active. And so rehab was really a precious time. And then I realized that they had to make me as strong as possible because I was going to be sent home in one of these. If I can. Technology, huh? All right, I'm joining the Luddite Club now. Don't tell me my remote is dying. Okay. There you go. The standard issue E&J special in 1973. This was the state of the art at the time. It weighed about 50 pounds. Had balloon tires. Hey, that was pretty cool. I'd never seen that before. And you know what? Mr. Everson, Mr. Jennings really deserve a lot of credit for this. This was a revolutionary thing that extended potential for people in its time. The folding wheelchair really made a big difference, because before then, what was the choice people had? The Mr. Potter chair, right? This was for pushing people around in, not for people to have independent control of their own mobility. And wow, look what I'm in now. Titanium frame, weighs less than 20 pounds. It's a rigid frame that doesn't waste energy from my push in the flexing of the frame. It's customized to my exact dimensions. I got shock absorbers on the front casters, ultra lightweight wheels, adjustable angle and height of the back, adjustable center of gravity. I got these cool natural fit hand rims thanks to Rory Cooper and the gang at Pittsburgh and the Boninger boys who put it out there. Are you guys here? Yeah, there he is. Okay. Now, I want you to know that that wasn't a paid commercial message. But Ron, if you want to slip me another pair, yeah, that'd be okay. Basically, it's much easier to push. It coasts extremely well. It puts less strain on my shoulders. It uses less of my energy. It's a lot more comfortable, and it looks great. And the symbolism is completely changed. This chair does not convey an image of medical loss and grief. This chair says that I am active and that I'm mobile and in control of my own life. And that is a requirement for anything that you do. People with disabilities are very sensitive to feeling like they look like they're more disabled. So any design that you come up with, regardless of how much you're increasing somebody's functionality, if it makes them feel like they look more disabled, that's going to be a problem. So you need to make that a high priority in any of the programming that you do in your work. Last thing we want to do is have people feel more sorry for us because we're in some weird-looking contraption. And it has been such a relief to have our image changed like this. So here's where we get to see one of the remaining serious obstacles. We have all this great design, all this technology, fantastic mobility devices, but it's getting harder and harder to get them paid for. What good is it for this stuff to exist if people can't get access to it? My insurance coverage actually has nothing in it for DME. Right? And recently we had an experience with CMS, the agency that administers Medicare and Medicaid, trying to reduce coverage for Group 3 power wheelchairs. This would have been a horrible situation. It would have compromised quality and manufacture and availability. And fortunately, they listened when the advocacy community spoke up and urged them not to do this. But now they're at it again. CMS is trying to institute a new policy for the lowest bidder, for a lowest bidder. Now, I had an experience with this once. I went through the process of working with a local prescription wheelchair dealer. They spent a lot of time consulting with me. They lent me chairs to use. We specified a new chair. And then my provider at the time wouldn't work with them, forced me to use a large provider. Truck driver shows up with a box, takes the chair out, has me sign a piece of paper, and he's gone. Now, I have the ability to adjust a wheelchair, but most other people are really going to be at a disadvantage with this, if they even get the right chair spec'd in the first place. So this is another thing that we really need to be fighting. We need to have proper coverage for mobility equipment. And I do have a way that you can help. Last fall in Washington, D.C., we held the second annual, well, it's going to be biannual now, but the second summit on spinal cord injury. And we had an amazing panel discussion on the last day with leaders from Paralyzed Vets, National Spinal Cord Injury Association, United Spinal, the Reeve Foundation. And these people all realized that the more they pooled their resources, the more they worked together, then the more we could be effective in situations like this. So we really invite you to join in with this. And anybody who's interested, please drop me an email. Here we go, Gary at lifeonwheels.org. And I can send you the information about how to participate in this. The SCI Leaders Group is one way that we're trying to make sure that we address these kinds of needs so people get access to this technology. Now, I was an 18-year-old kid, spinal cord injured, and hi. I'm not. Was that flirting? And it is on video. Uh-oh. Okay. So I'm an 18-year-old spinal cord injured kid, and I had a lot of adjustments to make. And one of the first major ones was realizing that disability was turning out to be nothing like I thought it was, and that the only thing that I had to go on at the time were whatever beliefs and assumptions I had absorbed about disability growing up, from my own projections and from the surrounding social view. So my view of disability was very much formed by stereotypes, that disability means that you're dependent on other people all the time, that it is necessarily an experience of loss and disappointment and difficulty, unless you're one of the rare, incredible, phenomenal, inspirational few who overcome their disability, right? The stereotype is of extremes instead of what it really is, just real people getting out there and doing what it takes with whatever tools and resources are available to us. Of course, there's the angry cripple stereotype. People always say this to me, well, if it happened to me, you know, I'd be angry. Even if I'm smiling, I think they believe underneath I must be mad because I'm paralyzed. We don't get to have sex, and we can't work. Now, this is a stereotype that is got a pretty strong grip in the business community, I'm finding. For them, disability, by definition, means can't work. For much of the business community, it's about workers' comp, it's about long-term disability plans, disability management, it's about regulations coming down on top of them and EEOC compliance officers breathing down their neck. And for them, the notion of disability as a feature for somebody is really kind of a foreign concept. And the notion of accommodation is a cost to them, rather than what they should be doing for everybody. You provide the tools and the resources and the setting so people can do the best job that they possibly can. So the business community has got a lot to learn about this. And when I do trainings and presentations to them, I talk about who people with disabilities are, this whole idea of radical change. I'm trying to catch them up with the truth of this story, actually invite them to visit their own beliefs and stereotypes, to see how they don't connect with the reality of it, this experience. And I address for them how people do this. I start telling business people about adaptive keyboards, about word prediction software, head cursors, voice relay and deaf relay, and things like JAWS and screen readers. And they've never seen this stuff. This is really a revelation to them. And they get it. They start to realize, wow, there are tools out there. And so this mystery of how do people with disabilities do this starts to come a little into perspective for them. Because I think that that stereotype of the extremes, especially the upside, the inspirational one, really puts people with disabilities at an advantage when they're a candidate for a job. I mean, just imagine manager interviewing somebody. In their mind, they're thinking, wow, I've got a visible disability. That looks like it would be really difficult if it was me. I don't know how I would do that. In other words, are they going to be that rare, incredible, unique, special individual that is overcoming their disability so they can do this job? You see how it raises the bar and puts people at a disadvantage? So no wonder the employment statistics for people with disabilities has hardly improved since the passage of the ADA 17 years ago. So there's been progress, but there's still a long, long way to go. And the business community has a great, great deal to do with taking advantage of this emergence of human capacity. I'd been accepted to architectural school just before my injury. I missed one term because of it, so as soon as I could, I went back to school, and here's Gary, the architecture student, with hair. And I arrive on campus, and I discover that the architecture building, and I want to repeat that for you, the architecture building was completely inaccessible. Half level up, half level down, no way for me to get in and out of the building. So I just had to wait by the stairs until people came along to give me a ride up and down. Now, there are a couple of advantages of this. One is that I got to meet almost everybody on campus because at some point they all had to lug me up and down the steps. But the other is this was training for me as an advocate. I developed relationships with the campus administration. We did articles in the school paper, got local television news to do a story about this. It took 5 years for this process to happen, but here comes my ramp at the Lawrence Tech School of Architecture in Southfield, Michigan. Huge roar of silence from the crowd. Bad remote. Bad, bad remote. So I got out of school. I worked in architecture briefly. Turned out that my real passion was graphic design. And I got a job working in the presentation graphics industry. I promise I'm not going to fall off the stage. An industry, you know, we used to make these things called 35-millimeter slides. Anybody remember those? Yeah. There's a whole industry that did this. And now it's blissfully put to death by computer technologies. But in 1980, this was a pretty cool thing. I was working on a system called Genographics. This was, you know, a workstation. There's a monitor, pen and a pad, keyboard, buttons, floppy drives, when floppies were really floppies. Right. This system was based on a digital PDP 1138 computer, for those of you who know about this kind of stuff. It cost $250,000, and it did 64 colors. Wow! This was incredible! Really. At the time, this was a radical thing. And then, in the 80s, PCs started appearing. People were buying software like Harvard Graphics, Lotus Freelance, PowerPoint, Cricut Presents, and so on. And we started getting requests for getting slides out of that software. So I was assigned the task of establishing a desktop services division in this company, Chartmasters, in San Francisco, where I worked. And we were one of the first ones in the game. We were a very professional organization with extremely high standards, so we did really well. We got off to a great start, set up an imaging center, people would modem in files, and it was going great. And my boss, the owner of the company, one day we're having a conversation in his office, and he's talking about how happy he is and that I've been doing a great job, and he says, "You've really, really done well. You're not disabled." Well, he was giving me a compliment. I understand this. But what I wish he had said instead was, "I understand now. A disability does not preclude somebody being able to work hard and be successful." This is the paradigm shift that the business community still really has to get. They got to get over the notion that disability equals inability to work and understand that is just a characteristic of who we are, and that things have changed so radically that they're missing out on an immense population of people who have so much to offer. So again, my message to business is, you know, if you're looking through the filter of all these stereotypes, you may very well miss somebody who's the best person for the job and might happen to have a disability. Right? And I think that that is the potential pain for them that we really got to get to so that they'll understand this. Then I developed chronic tendonitis in my wrists and elbows from my computer graphics career, being a workaholic, knowing nothing about ergonomics, because this information really was not around much in 1992. So my graphics career came to a grinding halt, and I was forced out of my job. So I spent a year off, trying my best to recover, deciding what I was going to do, and that's what led me into my consulting work as an ergonomics specialist. And then, in 1996, I was offered a contract to write my first book, Life on Wheels. So here I was, computer injured, I got a business to run, a book to write, and how was I going to do this? I did it with one of my favorite pieces of assistive technology, the Maltron keyboard. It means I don't have to flatten my hands, I don't have to bend my wrists as much, I got stuff going on in the thumbs. The proof of why this is a good design is because when I use a flat keyboard, I'm in pain in minutes. But I can use this as much as I need to, and it works for me. All right? And it works for me because it's the right design. Even if it's a little ugly, I love it. When it's the right design, it's going to get used, and that's always going to be the test. And another piece of technology, which is actually far more workable than my remote, everybody has autocorrect in Word. You know, it capitalizes I, it fixes misspellings when you leave an M out of accommodate or you just misspell the or something like this. I use this as an abbreviation expansion tool. I've got 200 or so commonly used words that are put in that I just need to hit one or two letters and the space bar, and it expands the word, which means that it reduces the number of keys that I have to press for a given amount of typing, and it makes me a lot more productive. Now, isn't it stupid that we should have to press a key for every letter of every word that we type now that we have computers? I want to see a standardized vocabulary of abbreviations that is part of every system so that we all commit to this. And that way we'll save a lot of people from injuring their hands and people will be a lot more productive in the process. Anybody want to take that one on? No? Actually, I have a few more ideas that I want to share with you that, you know, maybe some of you would be willing to commit to. Now, I have a big problem with the wide stalls in bathrooms, especially at airports. I end up sitting there with it used, looking at all the other empty ones that I can't get into. So I have this idea for a design for the bathroom stalls where when the wide stall is open and one of the others is available too, if somebody walks into the wide stall, there'll be some kind of a sensor system that can tell that there's somebody who walks. And then oh, this is such an unhappy situation. A force field will form around the toilet. Do we have the technology for this yet? Okay. Yeah. Or zap them. No, you don't want it to be causing any pain. Okay. Now, another major problem, of course, is disabled parking. And I've got a little collection of images here. Wait, am I covering up the sensor or something for this? There we go. There are a number of people in the world who, you know, they're disconnected enough from reality to not know that this is not a wise thing to do. I got a whole collection of them here. There's another one. And, you know, carrying my camera with me all the time. Now, this last one is really my favorite. Okay. Simple design solution, automatic tire slasher. Right? That'll take care of it. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then, how long is it going to be before we have the levitating wheelchair? There he goes. Om. I understand why people are uncomfortable with disability. They don't know how it works. And what else are they going to do but imagine what it would be like if it happened to them? How are they not going to imagine that it would be unremittingly difficult to live life with a disability? Until they have a direct personal experience of it, of course, they're probably going to get it wrong. So when somebody acquires a disability or business people start a process of considering this new truth of emerging human capacity, we're asking a lot of them. We're asking them to change. And there's really little that human beings hate more than change, right? But this was my experience with the ugly adaptive keyboard. If I wanted to work, I had to use it. I had to deal with the discomfort of change in order to do this. It took me 2 weeks to get used to the thing, but it got me through that initial period of discomfort. And you know what I found out? I found out that it's the right design. That what I was afraid of was nothing to be afraid of at all, because it turned out that it was a great solution. And that's what people in business need to learn about people with disabilities. This is another challenge that we all have to face to help them understand this. People with disabilities are a great solution. We're not looking to file disability claims. We're not looking to have them spend a fortune on reasonable accommodations. So many of us are just good people who want to do good work. Now, what I tell the business community is, change the balance. Don't think so much about the disability. Start with looking at the person. Think about, what are their abilities? What's their education? What are their goals? Why do they want to work with your organization? How are they going to be a good fit with all of their colleagues there? And then ask the question, how are you going to do the job? And you know what? If you get somebody who has an attitude problem, it's not because they're an angry cripple. It's because you hired somebody with an attitude problem. Right? Just because we have disabilities doesn't mean we're nice. I think there's sort of an equal spread in the population of people with disabilities as everybody else. Nice people, rude people, smart people, dumb people, you know. So it's people first. That's the thing that really matters. We are a great solution. Are you, like, tempted? I'm just sort of dying to see what I'm going to do with these. I don't know. What am I going to do with these? I tell the business community to be surprised, to assume that they don't know what disability is and how it works, and that people have abilities that they could never, ever imagine. Who knows? Some paralyzed guy might show up who's a juggler. Now, this is something that I never, ever thought that I would be able to do. And, of course, people see somebody succeeding at juggling and disability, and they think, that's impossible. How in the heck does that work? I could never do that. In other words, the only way you succeed at juggling or disability is to be really remarkable. Or, of course, we overcome. But that is not the way it works. It works by starting... That didn't happen. You start at the beginning. You set reasonable goals. You go at an appropriate pace. You reach out for the support and the resources that help you find the right way to do it. You're patient with yourself when it's a little weird and awkward at first, and after a while you've made another step. And then you start to sense that your body learns it on its own if you give it a chance, and before you know it, you've arrived at a goal. And you didn't do it without a certain amount of dropping. I did that one on purpose. You know, the cliche is true. Mistakes are not failure. They're information. You don't learn how to juggle without dropping a lot of balls, and you do not succeed with a disability without going through a lot of awkwardness and adjustment. But I was still limiting myself. I thought, all right, I've learned how to do this. That's kind of cool. But I've seen some other jugglers do some really fancy stuff, kind of like this, that, oh, okay, well, maybe I can do that one. But, I'm never going to do that really hard one that goes like, oh. Oh, Well, that's cool, but come on, how am I ever going to do this over the head? Oh, I get it. Instead of second guessing where I can go, just go out there, and when you understand that, then you're in a position to do some very cool showing off. Oh, no, I have another one. Some very cool showing off. Great crowd. Try it again. And then you find yourself doing some things that you really thought were completely impossible, and then new qualities of possibility start arriving in your life. And I have done what I forgot what I'm talking about. And okay, here comes the big finish. Yeah, baby! Not done. Okay. Here, Ray, you try it. This is what you all do. You imagine the impossible, and you find a way to make it possible. You get turned on by vision. You gather the resources and the skills and the people to make this kind of stuff happen. And you are willing to drop a lot of balls in the process, because that's what it takes to do it, right? So the spirit of Resna is very much like the spirit of juggling. You didn't know you were all jugglers, did you? I'm actually very, very excited about this historic place that we're in. I mean, think about that $250,000 workstation that did 64 colors, $2,000, blows it out of the water by factors of millions in 25 years, right? Look how far we've come. Same thing for people with disabilities. Just in the 34 years of my own experience has come incredibly far, and I think that the future holds a lot for them. We are going to see amazing, amazing stuff. And we have to remember a couple of important things. That this is not about hire the handicapped and help the poor, disadvantaged, disabled people. You know, that Jerry Lewis attitude is kind of deeply ingrained in our society. I think most of us know the difference. But I think we all have to stay on guard all the time to remember why we're doing what we do, that it's not by the grace of our goodness to help these people, but because they have a potential, they have a right to have a shot at it, and we make it possible for them to go there, but it's their choice, and we're doing it to benefit the world as a whole, not to make ourselves feel better because we're helping people who are so disadvantaged. But they have got responsibility too. People with disabilities have to understand that they need to be held to the same standard as everybody else. Some of them have been at a disadvantage. They've grown up with the bar lowered for them, and then they get out in the world and, oh my gosh, suddenly it's harder. So we need to help them catch up in ways that they were disadvantaged. But we also need to make sure they know that if they're going to be included in society and on par with all the rest of us, they should be held to the same standard as everybody else, because lowering the bar doesn't do anybody any good. Thank you. Somebody clapping for me? So, as a community, I know that we are going to continue to respond to these challenges. I know that we are going to keep looking for ways to remove these obstacles and extend the potential with our creative visions of what's possible for people. And that in the process, something very amazing is going to happen. As more and more people with disabilities get out there, everybody in the world, everybody in the society is going to see that they model something universal about all of us. That just by being human, we have a deep and innate capacity to adapt and survive. This is something that I found in myself that I have been amazed by throughout the entire disability experience that I didn't know I had until I was required to dig down deep and find out it was there, not because I'm so rare and special, but because it is universally human. And they're going to model that nobody likes being denied their potential when they know what is possible for them. And indeed, we are part of an incredibly exciting, revolutionary, historic time, and I'm very honored to be sharing the ride with you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks. Think so? I did. And so on behalf of Resna, I want to thank you for that great performance. And we have a little token of our appreciation. And the proverbial check is in the mail.
Cool.
And you're going to stay for the conference, right?
I'm going to be here through tomorrow.
Okay.
Yep.
So you'll see you in the exhibit hall.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And we'll see you at the plenary in the morning. We'll see you at the workshops.
You bet.
And stay for the ice cream social.
Oh, yeah, you bet. Ice cream. Right. Thank you again so much.
And now I'd like to introduce the president of Resna, Glenn Hedman.
Thank you. I was told that suits were required. One program note, because of the heat, the award ceremony appetizer has been changed from sushi to broiled fish. Hope that's okay with everybody. I don't want to say it was hot today, but Al Gore was seen at the board of directors meeting this afternoon. So, all right, enough. We're all thrilled to see all of you here. It's been 12 months of work. I want to compliment Ray and the meetings committee on all the work they've done. Working just as hard is Resna's Executive Director Tom Gorski and the Resna office staff. They've really done a fantastic job. As you note, the theme for this year's conference is Resna Many Disciplines, One AT Family, and we're thrilled to have our family assembled for this conference. And like any family event, we try to spread the fun out along the way, and in so doing, we want to recognize family members for the outstanding contributions that they've made. And in so doing, we're going to spread the awards out throughout the various sessions. Tonight, I'd like to introduce Awards Committee Chair Dave Jaffe to start that off.
Okay. Thank you, Glenn. So this year we're trying something different to spread out the awards among several days. So there'll be a few this evening, some tomorrow morning, some Monday morning, but the main body of them will be on Monday evening. I invite you all to attend. I will tell you that it will be an event that you won't forget. Okay. Right now, could Glenn Ashlock and Rich Simpson make their way to the stage? They better be here. There's Glenn. There's Rich. Okay, where's the control? Oh, it's hidden. Okay. The Certificates of Appreciation recognizes Resna members or non-members for an activity they've done over the year or several years in the fields of rehab or assistive technology or service to Resna. And it's been a tradition within Resna to acknowledge the contributions and accomplishments of members of the board who have served their term and are leaving the board of directors. And tonight we have two people who we want to recognize. on behalf of Resna. Without their dedication, passion, commitment, and volunteerism, Resna as a professional organization would cease to exist. So the outgoing members of the Resna Board of Directors for this year are Glenn Ashlock and Kate Seelman, who is not here. We will mail her award to her. And finally, Rich Simpson. Okay. Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow morning.
Okay, so a bit of final housekeeping before we go into the openings of the exhibit. A number of you have brought your families here this year, which is great. And those of you who have young children with you, please raise your hands. Okay, so I suggest that you might want to connect in the back of the room after this session so you could trade numbers and so forth and see if you can link up. There's a movie at 8 o'clock for families, starting 8 o'clock tonight, out by the main pool, and other activities that you can facilitate, that they have going on here aimed at families and young children. Now, as they say, you've all heard that, the conference marches on its stomach. So we want you to eat, but, of course, I want you to be on time. Especially for the morning plenaries. They begin at 9 o'clock. I just want to let you know that the Biltmore Grill will have a great buffet set up to get you through the line quickly in the morning. The cafe will have extra staff on hand, including the all-important coffee stand, express line. I'm told that the Adobe Cafe, which is across the road, straight from the entrance and to the right a little bit, I believe, at the Golf Pro Shop. They make a pretty mean breakfast burrito and have an affordable lunch as well. So give yourself plenty of time for breakfast and don't miss any of the presentations. We'll also have lunch available in the exhibit halls on Sunday and Monday. And with a conference with so much going on, mistakes and last-minute changes do happen. So please take special note at the program changes board right in the entry area to the MacArthur room. Some workshops the rooms have been moved around, some schedule changes, so don't be disappointed and just check that out. So now on to the exhibit hall. But before I do the exhibit hall, for those of you who are trying to go for CEUs and collect CEUs, I know you want to start getting the habit of collecting the number that you have to put down at the bottom of your evaluation form for this session. So the number is 7783. You'll be asked about that in the morning. 7783. And we also have bingo cards at the end of the conference and special prizes if you line them up. Okay, now on to the exhibit hall, one of the cornerstones of our conference. I really encourage you to visit all the booths. We've encouraged the exhibitors to challenge you with new information and interact with you, maybe in ways that you haven't experienced before. Really want to have them tell you what they're doing, and I want you to challenge them to get you new information. Also, get out the cards in your tote bags with this new passport for prizes for a chance to win some valuable items. So look for that. And the exhibit hall is out the main doors and up the slope to the left. And have some food, meet some exhibitors, connect with your friends and make new ones along the way. And thank you for coming.